Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. People are living longer, healthier, and more productive lives than ever before, but stereotypes about older adults, those 65 and up, are holding them back. And more, they want to work, continue learning, engage with technology, and because of all that, they represent a major untapped economic resource. It's called the longevity economy, the focus of a new report by AARP. It says that in the U.S. alone, there are more than 100 million older people, many of whom may live beyond the age of 100. There's a link to the report at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us today is the board chair for AARP, Joan Roth. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here.
I kind of gave sort of what I thought was a thumbnail sketch of longevity economy and what it means. Can you tell us what you mean in your report?
Certainly. Let me give a little historical background so we understand what's happening in the demographics today. First of all, let's look at if you had been born in the early 1900s, you would have had a life expectancy of like 47. Today, someone born today has a life expectancy of anywhere between 78 and 80. Yet if you reach 65, you're going to have another 20 years of life expectancy. This is totally different than what many of our systems in the country are geared for. It creates opportunities, but it also creates some challenges that we need to look at. And so what at AARP we think about is what we call disrupt aging. We need to rethink how we talk about aging, how we think about the systems we have in place, how we think about caregiving, and how we talk about aging in general.
I heard an interesting interview the other day on NPR, and it referred the person being interviewed said that when they were younger, they thought of the aged population as sort of an ethnic group, something that they weren't part of. And now that they're in their 50s, they're like, yeah, it's an ethnic group that everybody can join eventually. So they felt apart from it. Is that part of the problem?
That's an interesting way of looking at it.
I certainly
know that when I was in college, you didn't trust anybody over 30.
Right.
And now you don't trust anybody over 100. So when you look at it, a lot of that is how we develop products for individuals, how we think about lifestyles, how we advertise, instead of really focusing on this generation, the baby boom generation, how we have grown, we've increased in demographics. We are, those who are 85 and above are the largest and fastest growing segment of the population. And we're changing everything. You know, we changed things when we went through grade school. We're now changing the concept of aging. And it's a tremendous economic opportunity for businesses. So, for example, there are 111 million people who are 65 and over. And it is an economy of about $7.6 trillion annually in the United States. And that is a tremendous amount of opportunity that people have not really tapped like they should.
The report looked at 12 countries, including the United States. How were those? Are we talking about apples and apples or apples and oranges? How did you select those?
We looked at 12 countries, and it ran the gamut from, say, Japan, which has the oldest society in the world, to South Africa, which is one of the younger countries, which only has 5% of the population who are over 65. We picked countries looking at a cross section, but we focused on those who had the largest economic impact in their particular regions. We look, okay. So some of them are what I would call high-income countries, and some of them are middle-income countries. And we found a lot of great information. We call it the Aging Readiness and Competitiveness Report. And we looked at how countries were dealing with issues and what some of the best practices are, what some of the pitfalls are, and how, in fact, those countries who are just beginning to get their populations into what would be called aged or super-aged, some of the things that they should be looking at to really be ready for when their population becomes super-aged. And we looked at it from basically four standpoints. We looked at it from community, social infrastructure, not only social infrastructure, but fiscal infrastructure. We looked at the productive opportunity. How do we bring older individuals into the workforce? technological engagement, because a lot of what's going on in the world today, and which will really keep individuals as part of the economic engine, is how they adapt to technology. And then the last is healthcare and wellness, which is a very critical area. And so we looked at it from all of those standpoints.
Were there some countries more culturally amenable to the aging population boom than others?
The different countries have different cultural aspects, and culture is a very big determinant of how a country reacts to all populations. For instance, Israel, which is not a super age country yet, it's a younger country, their culture is one where they really do incorporate how they deal with younger population and older population, and they have a great respect for the older population. Mexico's another that is a very family-oriented culture, and so as a result, how they look at aging, how they look at long-term care becomes very family-oriented as well. For instance, Japan, which is a super-age society, and they've been a super-age society since 2006.
Lot of really old people.
Which means that one out of four are 65 and over.
Okay.
So a super-age society is a society, and this is defined by the UN, as a society that has 21% or more of your population 65 and above. So anyway, they've had not only the need to look at how they deal with an aging population, but they've had the opportunity to start looking at policies and to working through some policies.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the longevity economy. That is the potential, you know, and the loss potential as we grow up in a society of more and more older adults, 65 and older. The baby boomer population is aging right now. It's retiring, and they've changed things all along the way. As my guest, Joan Ruff, she's board chair for AARP, just said, they have produced a report on this. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question for Joan Ruff about the study, about aging in the United States, about the longevity economy, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The community social infrastructure piece of this, it breaks that up into three elements: preventing social isolation, promoting social engagement, and engagement. Isn't that all part of the same thing?
Each one is a little different,
okay,
but it all does link together. And one thing about the longevity economy, it all links together, because it's a sort of a domino effect. When you look at social infrastructure, it is both physical infrastructure and how physical infrastructure can, in fact, inhibit that social infrastructure. One of the major things that's happening throughout the globe is isolation and social isolation, which leads to loneliness. And how do we, in fact, incorporate social structures so that people have the chance to talk with each other, to get out and about, to be able to learn from each other and to lead healthy lives, because loneliness does lead to poor health. For example, in England, they recognize that loneliness is a huge issue. And so just last week, the Prime Minister, Theresa May, announced an initiative in Great Britain to really tackle and study loneliness. And the first aspect of that was to set up a ministerial office on loneliness. And several of the issues that they were looking at, they recognized that they had many, many people in the UK, and they also have this in Japan, who never talked to anybody who is a human being for maybe more than once or twice a month. This leads to depression, which can lead to shorter, healthy lifespans. And so they're going to be studying that, and that's going to be a great resource for all of us.
Once or twice a month, I mean, don't they even go to the grocery store or go out to eat or do anything like that?
A lot of that then goes to the physical infrastructure. Okay. So if you can't get to the grocery store because the sidewalks, you can't get to the sidewalk, or you don't have a bus that you can walk to due to very small sidewalks or crumbling infrastructure, they don't necessarily have the ability to get out to the grocery store. One of the things that we do in the United States that is very helpful is Meals on Wheels. So on Meals on Wheels, at least people have the opportunity to have somebody come in once a day to bring a meal, and they have a little interaction from that standpoint.
You hear about the interaction more than you do the food, usually.
Yes, most people think of it as food, but it is the interaction that really becomes incredibly important.
Why does loneliness affect health that way?
When you're lonely, you sit around and become very depressed. And again, it might be a cause and effect, too. If you are beginning to have dementia, diabetes, unable to really get around, then you start isolating yourself and you become lonely.
Promoting social engagement, what does that look like?
Promoting social engagement is a way that we can make sure that there are ways for people to talk with each other and interact. Throughout the world, different organizations, different countries are doing different things, but they all boil around making sure that there's community support for getting opinions, for people to come in and socialize. It may be a community center. It may be, for example, in the long-term care area, having communities where you recognize that individuals are not really able to live independently, but they don't need care constantly. So as a result, you will have a community center where individuals are living together and they're basically helping each other and looking after each other. You know, I know my mother, when she was in her early 90s and lived in a small town, she lived by herself, but she had people who would come by and stop by to see her all the time. So she had that social interaction. And if you live in a large city and you don't know your neighbors, you're not going to get that social interaction.
What's the difference then between social engagement and then the third prong of that engagement? What's the difference?
Well, social engagement is the one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, engagement otherwise is making sure that you are learning. Okay. You are perhaps learning in the work. You are going back to the workforce. You are engaging in all aspects of life. And if you're engaging in all aspects of life, then you are able to continue to lead the best life you possibly can.
We've learned a lot about how the brain operates in the last 20 years, and I'm wondering how much that comes into play. Obviously, there are brain diseases that they're still working on, everything from Parkinson's to Alzheimer's that's another issue, but a healthy brain in an older adult is still a teachable brain.
Exactly. And it's a brain that wants to learn. And you bring up another area that's extremely important, and that is the difference between life expectancy and what we call healthy life expectancy. And healthy life expectancy, that gap in the United States is 5.7 years. In the United States, that gap is a little greater than the median for all the other countries we studied.
Does that mean people are living that much longer, but they're not healthy?
Yes. What that means is that they need care, maybe it means long-term care costs, more health insurance and more health care costs. And why do we have this health this gap? And a lot of it comes from what we call non-communicable chronic diseases like diabetes, obesity, all of those things that dementia, those are the kinds of things that healthier lifestyles may be able to help or may not. But when we have those diseases, then people are not able to necessarily live the healthiest life until their actual life expectancy, until the general life expectancy time frame.
Older adults are living longer, they're learning more, they're engaging more if we let them. My guest is Joan Ruff. She's board chair for AARP, which released a new study on the topic of the longevity economy. We have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about the longevity economy, getting old in America, and what it means to the rest of us and what it means to me. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The stereotype of the older adult as a drag on the American economy may be the greatest drag of them all. Older adults are living longer, healthier lives, and the 50 and up age group represents a driving economic force here and around the world if we let it. It's called the longevity economy. That is all the activity driven by the needs of Americans 50 and older. That's what we're talking about. Still with us is board chair for the AARP, Joan Ruff. They have a new report out on the longevity economy. You can look to that at the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us by phone is sociologist and research fellow at the Scripps Gerontology Center at Miami University, Kate DiMaderos. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Kate, you study the cultural structures affecting the experience of aging. What are some of the cultural myths related to advanced age?
Well, I think the big one is is what older people are able to do. So, you know, we have the adage, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, mm-hmm. which, of course, is not true at all. Learning occurs throughout the lifespan, and so does creativity. But a lot of the experience of aging is shaped by the way people treat older people. So if you think about ageism, for example, in American culture and look at commercials or other ways that older people are portrayed, it's often as either very helpless or very silly or things that can really devalue the person. And then in turn, the person might buy into that stereotype, and it has this cascading negative effect.
I was wondering, Joan Ruff, can you talk about the us versus them thing? What do you know about where that comes from?
Like then the ageism concept. Some of it is self-imposed. I mean, we as people who are 50 and above, I mean, for instance, people think about AARP, say, oh, I'm 50. I'm now eligible for AARP. And it is an honor, and there are so many things going on. And we self-impose it on ourselves thinking like, oh, wow, I just had a senior moment. Or somebody will say, you're too old to wear something like that. And companies think about the possibility of, is it costing me more to have an older worker, when it really isn't, because the experience is so important in what they're doing.
But if they even start to ask the question, it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly. And some of the things that we need to think about are diversity. As we talk about diversity, very few people think of diversity of age and the different experiences that people have as they age and how that comes to help all of the decision making and everything that we as a world are doing.
Kate DiMaderos, we weren't always like this, were we, or were we?
Sadly, we always have been.
Okay.
There's a kind of this ideal that there was this golden time when elders were revered and, you know, sought after for knowledge. But really, that applied to a very select few. It generally applied only to men, say in Rome and Greece, you know, men of power and stature. And the whole idea of, you know, elders being revered really is centered more on what skills people can pass along. So people who had skills to pass along in early societies were respected, but if you were kind of one of 10 people who did the same thing, not so much. So we like to think there was this time when, you know, old age was a special period in life, but really not anywhere in the world is that really the case.
You and your students at Miami University have worked on Oxford's Age-Friendly City Project. What does that do?
Well, we are really excited. It's part of AARP initiative. And so I have first-year students who didn't sign up to do Age-Friendly Cities. They signed up for research. And so now they're suddenly looking at Oxford from the perspective of what do people with diverse needs need? You know, how do businesses treat people? Are they open to people of all ages? Are they only open to, you know, the college-age students? So it's been really wonderful to see these students suddenly realize, I never thought about age, or I never thought about, you know, mobility or other things. And so from their perspective of taking this look at the community, it's just been wonderful.
I wanted to talk about, Joan Ruff, the productive opportunity that's referenced in the report, the desire among older adults to remain productively engaged outstrips, and how it outstrips the opportunity to do so. What are the barriers there?
The barriers become cultural, and all countries are recognizing that they want to be competitive, and the best way to be competitive is to have more people in the workforce. So at the same time, we're also realizing that with lower birth rates and as people being encouraged to retire, there are fewer and fewer workers. So how do we then make sure that we are able to bring back and use the experiences and the skills of that older workforce? That's going to take a combination of people rethinking aging, again, going to the ageism issues, human resource policies, and the government. Now, what most countries are doing, and the United States has been in this area as well, is to look at their pension systems and raise the age of the pension system. Now, that only takes one aspect of the whole issue. It means that individuals also have to be able to work. So we need to look at intergenerational workforces, which are more productive, which are more creative. We need to look at, again, diversity. And right now, only 7% of CEOs say that they include age in their diversity initiatives. So again, it's that rethinking. It's looking at phased retirements. It's looking at maybe reduced work schedules. It's returnships. So for instance, if you want to retool and come back and do something else, how do we take the time off to be able to have that retooling and then come back with our skills?
How did 65 become that kind of retirement age, Kate DeDemiros?
Well, it's Otto von Bismarck. So the beginning of the welfare state in the late 1800s, mm-hmm. when industrialization started to bring people from the country to the city, and some of the safeguards that used to exist, say churches and just neighbors helping out, started to go away. So it was Chancellor Otto von Bismarck who originally set the age at 70. You know, he did a survey of his, the people's ages and decided that that was the age where there was a real break-off, so they could afford to supply pensions for that group. And then he eventually lowered it to 65. So 65 just became this magic number, really based on how much money was available in Bismarck's time period to pay for the pensions of people who were no longer able to work and whose families couldn't afford to support them.
And at that time, the average longevity was like 40, 45 years.
Well, you have to be careful with that number because it's average life expectancy, right, which meant that only one in five children survived past age five, which brought the number down.
Okay.
So people still lived into very old age, and they always have. It's just that there are more people now who survive childhood,
okay,
who then grow to be older. So it's kind of a little misleading of a figure. So people it wasn't common for people to die in their 40s. It was just common for people to not survive childhood.
But it was also more common for people as they age to be less healthy, wasn't it, or not?
I guess it's kind of a tricky thing. The records aren't that good. It just really depends. You did have people who were doing a lot of physical work. So if you were a laborer, you might have consequences of that. But on the other hand, you had people walking. And so, you know, there were some positive effects of exercise. Of course, there was no treatment for a lot of diseases, and so infections could be deadly.
Going back to the older adults who want to, sometimes have to be working, mm-hmm. that's how they have to support themselves and want to be, there's a bit in the Academy Award-nominated movie Lady Bird where the father and the son are competing for the same job. And it kind of plays into that stereotype, Joan Ruff, that it's a zero-sum game.
Well, we know that the more productive a country is, the more jobs there are, and the more people who are working, the more money that is generated. They then buy more products, and more products continue to increase the productivity of the country, which increases the number of jobs that are needed. So we need to begin to rethink how we are using people. And I think a very important way is when the father, son, if they're competing, or those different generations, that companies need to be thinking about how do we use the skills of both of them. And that goes back to intergenerational workforces. which have been deemed to be much more creative, much better at problem solving. And the older worker brings the experience and sort of the calmness. The younger worker brings that can-do attitude and also brings that technological vibrancy. And so when they're all working together, it's just a much more productive environment.
The Iridori project in Japan was highlighted in the report. What was that about?
That's the one about the leaves, correct?
I think so, yeah.
Yes. On the Iridori project in Japan, there is a village that is close to Iridori leaves, which are very specialized leaves that are used in table settings in Japan. What Japan has been doing is saying, we want to use technology to be able to bring our older individuals back into the working environment. Through using technology, they have been able to allow the residents of to work with consumers who want these leaves. And so they are able to, in effect, order leaves, know how many leaves they need to set up relationships, and they go out and cultivate the leaves or reap the leaves and send them out. So it becomes a whole new system that they didn't have before.
And that they created for older people.
And they created it with older people in mind. And the another one that they're doing in Japan, too, again, creating with older individuals in mind, is agriculture. So outside of Tokyo, there are many, many farms that are being farmed by 65 and older. And they are now renting their farms, again through technology, to individuals in Tokyo who then look at how their farmland is doing through the internet. They see and look at using sensors, determine how dry are the fields, et cetera. And then they send information to the farmer who owns the land but is renting it to the individual to what they need to do and how they should be farming. So again, it's bringing two groups together and helping to bring more consistent money to the older generation.
Kate DiDomiros, what are you learning about from those kinds of examples and others about teaching younger people, and I don't say like to say young people, I say younger people, how to view the world as someone who is older and how to bridge that gap going forward?
Well, one of the things that I deal with here at the university is that students will take a class on, say, global aging, but not really quite knowing what it's about.
Right.
And then they realize, oh, my gosh, it's about aging. didn't know that. But the more they learn and the more they realize that they've had these biases or that they haven't thought about age or that a lot of classes don't even include old age as a topic, that they really start to see the world differently. And I really think that if we can get younger people, you know, throughout the life course to understand that age isn't something that, you know, there's no bingo gene that hits you at age 65. You know, you don't fundamentally change who you are. You are you. And that the stereotypes that they have been taught or that they haven't had challenged are what are really narrowing their thinking. So, you know, I think the more that we can educate not only younger people, but as was brought up before, even people who are advancing in age themselves to not look at their lives as, oh, well, I'm over 50 now, you know, it's all downhill from here. There are a lot of cultural reasons why we think that are embedded in our history that really need to be challenged.
Why are the boomers challenging that versus other generations, do you think, Joan Ruff?
As boomers, we've challenged everything. And I think that that's part of it, you know, it's built into our psychic. We grew up in a generation when there was great change going on, you know, first person on the moon, microwave ovens, so much technology that really took place. And so that's just, it's in our psychic.
And the whole technological piece of this, I mean, I do a whole show once a week on tech. Because it's such a big part of our lives now. Kate DiDomiros, I mean, what are the stereotypes about that, and what are you teaching your students?
It's funny because the students like to think that they are technologically advanced, and I like to point out that they do Instagram really well. Facebook is not so much popular with them anymore. But you know, when it comes to doing an Excel spreadsheet, you know, they're a little bit lacking. And so rethinking, you know, how first of all, they assume that everyone wants to be on Instagram, which is of course not true. But they assume that people can't understand the technologies, and so again, it's a lot of myth busting, and a lot of this, of course, depends on your age and if you were tired using certain technologies. But certainly, people are able to learn new technologies. They may not want to, but that's not a factor of age. It's a factor of prior exposure, and so it's important for them to learn that.
Yeah, Joan Ruff, are there some countries that are doing better than others? You mentioned Japan in terms of the workforce, but what about other tech?
Well, Japan is, again, on the forefront, recognizing tech is, you know, the key to the future for many people. One of the issues is how do you train older individuals in technology? Because they have the ability. What happens is that we don't necessarily provide the right environment for them to learn. And we know that if they are taught by people their own age, that there becomes an ability to work back and forth, and they don't feel stigmatized or embarrassed by having some younger individual who is great on Instagram, but as was pointed out, don't know anything about Excel worksheets. And so it's the environment that becomes very important. Japan is doing a lot of work in that. Germany, United States, in the United States, when I need some help, I go down to the Apple store. And I don't see a whole lot of older people there. I see quite a few, but I see an awfully lot of young kids. Mm-hmm. And so it can be an intimidating environment for somebody who is trying to learn a particular aspect of technology when, as we know, when you've got a bunch of school kids running around, it's not a terribly quiet environment.
No, it's not.
It's the environment that becomes very crucial to how they learn.
Healthcare. The approaches to long-term healthcare have been affected a lot by this rapidly aging population. How does the healthcare piece change dramatically?
Well, the healthcare piece is very much focused on as well that gap between healthy life and life expectancy. And again, as is pointed out, yes, it is an individual basis, but we do look at what is the average. And with that, we need more and more long-term care. And where is that coming from? We do not have enough long-term care workers. And right now we have an informal system in the United States where people are providing unpaid care to their loved ones or neighbors. And right now there are about 40 million of those individuals. And the value of the support they are giving has been valued at like $470 billion a year. So the question is, how do you keep that system going, because there are many, many costs to it. So the person who is the caregiver has not only financial costs, because oftentimes they have to leave the workforce to go and take care of mother or dad. There are psychological costs, because the stress involved when you get a call from a caregiver or your mother falls or something like that becomes very, very difficult. And again, it leads to isolation. One of the things that I'm very proud of what's happening now in the United States, the RAISE Caregivers Act was just implemented a couple of weeks ago.
What is that?
And the RAISE Caregiver Act is an act that requires the Secretary of Health and Human Services to focus on and come up with a strategy, study, and a plan for how we, in fact, help those caregivers who are unpaid. And that study should be out in about 18 months. But it will focus on all of those issues.
We'll continue our conversation on the longevity economy, on the tens of millions of Americans 65 and older, what kind of positive impact they can have, and what biases and stereotypes about them can, how that can drag them. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about what is called the longevity economy and a new report from AARP. It's about the economic impact of the aging population in the United States. We're living longer and doing more as we age. You can read more about the report at the link on our website at WOSU.org/All Sides. Still with us is AARP Board Chair Joan Ruff and also by phone sociologist and research fellow at the Scripps Gerontology Center at Miami University, Kate DiMederos. I wanted to focus a little bit more on the perception that older Americans are draining the economy again. As you said, that's actually no. There's as many jobs. The more jobs there are, the more jobs there are. It's the other way around. And Kate DiMederos, what are you learning from your students about their impressions about the impact, the economic impact of older Americans?
Well, I think that there are, again, a lot of misconceptions. So they feel that the older Americans in the workforce are taking up all the high-paying jobs, mm-hmm. and not leaving them opportunities to advance, that they don't bring, you know, new and modern approaches to thinking about things like business, or that they, you know, again, they just simply feel like they're in the way. And those are the stereotypes that we have to counteract. But again, these are also things that get reinforced, unfortunately, through media, movies, TV, commercials, and other things.
So the idea that someone's in the way, no, actually, they're earning a living, mm-hmm. paying their taxes, doing their thing. That can't be in the way. Is that right, Joan Ruff?
Yeah,
they're in the way when they're not contributing anything.
Well, and yet people who – there are many contributions by people who are not in the paying workforce. Mm-hmm. And some of those contributions are through volunteerism. And the amount of volunteerism and the activity is very, very great among the older population. And that is helping to make not-for-profits more and more vital, services more and more vital. Again, the caregiving individuals who are working, you know, $470 billion a year in value that's going on there. The other thing that people don't stop and think about when they have this perception is how much money that the older population is putting into the economy. And so you think about what is it that they really want to do, the older population. They want to travel, and that costs money. They want to take their grandkids places. That helps their grandkids. It gives them a broader perspective. They spend money on their grandkids. They spend money on their kids. They also pay taxes to help support schools. And they want to age in place. So that means when they're aging in place that oftentimes they need to retrofit their houses. And when you're retrofitting your house, that means you are giving jobs, you are putting back into the economy for those people who are helping you to retrofit. So those are the kinds of things that people don't think about when they talk about what is the role of the older individual in the economic environment in the country. They are not takers. They, in fact, are great givers.
Judy in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Judy.
Yes, I just wanted to talk about the Program 60 program. Anyone who is 60 and over can take any class at Ohio State for free, no tuition, no admission process, no fees. There has to be space available in the class, and the professor has to say you can take it. But any state school has Program 60, where any senior can take classes for free. I took one in architectural history and theory. I took two in the art history department. And it's a really wonderful program because you can get retrained. You can get out there and hang out with 20-year-olds. You get a student ID so you can get cheap movie tickets. So I just wanted to recommend that, Program 60.
Okay, that's something that you hear about occasionally, but not a lot about it. Judy, you said you can hang out with people in their 20s, but do you see other people like you around your age doing this?
Well, the art history class, I think there was 10 of us in the one class.
Okay.
just because a lot of people like art history. A lot of people will take a language because they want to travel. And you're a student. You get a grade. Now, the good thing is you don't have to take exams, and you don't have to do papers if you don't want to.
Uh-huh.
You don't get a grade. You just audit.
But if you
but
do, if you do,
were very accepting.
But if you do do the papers or take the exam, they'll grade you?
They'll grade you, yes. Huh. But you won't get credit for it.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Judy. That's good to know. That goes to that learning piece and potential.
Exactly. That how do you retool? How do you retrain? How do you start thinking about what you want to do next in your life? And that's something that the younger millennials need to think about through this aging longevity economy, because they are going to be living longer. And so they need to start planning how they are going to live the rest of their life. Are they going to be taking maybe sabbaticals every 10 years to retool and coming back into a different working environment? So there's exciting things for them to think about.
You know, Kate DeDemiros, when you worked on the Oxford's Age-Friendly City Project, mm-hmm. what did you learn about how businesses can better tailor products and services to older adults?
Well, I think accessibility is the big thing. So
physical
is huge, and things like parking. Where's the parking located? But the other big thing is, can you hear? So if a business is, say it's a restaurant and they don't have acoustic tiles, it can be really difficult for people to have conversations. So things that businesses might not even think about, you know, how does the sound carry? You know, directly affects whether people are able to sit and have lunch there or not. You know, is the music too loud? You know, those kinds of things that may not be obvious. So we're finding a lot of embedded things. Where are the restrooms? You know, is there a place to sit inside, or do you have to stand? So those little things that I don't think the business owners are necessarily thinking about are things that we're finding may have an impact on whether older people are able to access those, or anyone, really, not just older people.
All of this aggregated, Joan Ruff, how does this, in terms of how the United States stacks up against other countries, what does it say about our competitiveness going forward if we're all aging and if we're not at the forefront?
United States is doing well in many areas, but it has a ways to go in other areas. Perhaps its biggest place where it's a laggard is in the health care. And, you know, we spend more money than people in other countries, and we have worse outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
We're the only country that makes it, of the 12 that we studied, that really does not have some sort of universal health care that makes sure that people do have the availability of health care.
And you're saying that shows in the outcomes.
That's showing in the outcomes. We have a smaller digital divide between older individuals and the younger cohort than any of the other countries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's very good.
Mm-hmm.
Question is, are we using the abilities of the older population who do have that technological availability as well as we should? And one of the things that happens is that we have young people designing products. And when young people design products, they don't understand what some of the complications that were just talked about that older people may have. And so how do you get that younger population who are designing products to understand? One of the areas that, or one of the companies or groups is really looking at that is MIT Age Lab.
Hmm.
And the MIT Age Lab, actually we started it with AARP was one of their initial funders, and we continue to work with them. They, in fact, look at product design for older individuals and how they need to be factored into anything that happens. So, for instance, a car. How do you get in and out of a car easily? And again, if you can design something that's easy to get in and out, it helps not only an older individual, it helps all people.
It's
universal design. And another thing that they've done at MIT, and this goes to the idea, can you hear in a restaurant? Can you easily push buttons on an iPhone? And that is to help them understand what it's like. So they developed a suit that is basically that you put on that has bands on it and weights on it to mimic what it's like to have arthritis at different levels, and also what it's like to be able to not see because you may have macular degeneration or some other eyesight issue. And again, to the ability not to be able to hear. So when individuals are able to actually put this on, experience it, then they can translate that to when they're designing products. And it's been very successful in how the younger people say, I now see what I should be thinking about.
It reminds me of back when the School of Communications at Michigan State, where I attended, started their opened up their new building. This was 100 years ago, but it had heated sidewalks and it had all, was all universally designed, and it was beautiful and it was made it easier for everybody. Kate DeDemaros, what do your students tell you about what they perceive the world to be if it were designed for older people?
Well, again, having now that they've gotten out in the community,
again,
they just see things differently, and they see other students who have disabilities or challenges also differently. So it's they're seeing less about age and more about access. They're less frightened about this thing called age or these people called older people that seem worlds away from them or alien, and they're now seeing the way that they come together. One thing I make them do is there's an app called Age Booth, and it ages your picture 40 years. So I make them take a picture of themselves and age themselves and then look at it and say, this is older people are you in 40 years from now, or however many years.
Weird.
So it's kind of funny. They argue about how accurate it is, and I tell them that's not the point. It's free, so call me back in 40 years and tell me how accurate it is. But it does help them actually see themselves, too, and say this isn't about them. It's about me. It's about all of us.
The Netflix series Grace and Frankie has focused on entrepreneurship in older age. Both of the main characters played by Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin, are pursuing their different entrepreneurial inclinations. Is that typical? Are you finding it more, or is there enough capital out there for people, or do they have the confidence in them? Joan Ruff?
I don't watch that Netflix program, but to the issue of entrepreneurship, there are a lot of people who have taken their encore life into entrepreneurship. And again, there are a lot of support services, perhaps not enough. Are they able to get the financing that they need?
Yeah.
It's probably more difficult. But again, many, many people are looking at that as an alternative and doing something they've always wanted to do.
Yeah. Kate DeDemaros, is there a demand out there for that kind of a thing? Do you know? Or
well, it's interesting. We have a program in entrepreneurship here at Miami, and we've just partnered with them to offer an online master's in social entrepreneurship and aging. So the idea is that there are a lot of people, especially people in careers, so not necessarily people who might be retired, although not excluded, but people who might be midway in their career and suddenly realize, there's a lot of missing opportunities or products or programs for older people. So we're seeing a lot of interest in people becoming aware of the population aging and maybe through family or their own experiences that there are a lot of things lacking for older people. So it is something that we're seeing interest in. And I get a lot of students from the business school who are in the entrepreneurship program who want to take classes on aging because they want to better understand how they, as emerging entrepreneurs, could meet the needs. So I see a lot of need, a lot of interest from the students themselves as well.
Kate DeDemaros, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Kate DeMadeiros is an associate professor of sociology and research fellow at the Scripps Gerontology Center at Miami University. Also, Joan Ruff, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Joan Ruff is board chair for AARP. Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.